Coming today on Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast.
No one has ever come through the door with their checkbook out and their pen in hand saying to me, "Hey, Susan, when do I get to write that first alimony check?"
Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two divorce attorney girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
Breaking Free Mediation is proud to be the very first family law mediation centers in the country to offer a mindfulness track. Breaking Free Mediation, helping you resolve family law matters peacefully. Learn more at www.breakingfreemediation.com.
Also, make sure to download your free calming meditation from renowned meditation and energy expert Scott Picard at www.breakingfreefromdivorce.com/free meditation.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free. Welcome to today's podcast. Our topic today, alimony, the real facts about the scariest word in divorce. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. So alimony, spousal support, it doesn't matter what words you use. These are words that strike fear in the hearts of divorcing people everywhere. But as a divorce attorney for so many years, I've actually found that many clients don't understand legally what spousal support is. And it really is actually one of the most complicated issues in any divorce. So today we're going to give you an overview of the law around alimony so that you can have at least a good general idea of what to expect as you go through the divorce process. So one universal that I can say about alimony is that no one wants to pay it.
Yeah, that is so true. It's like the first thing they say, am I going to have to pay alimony? Or, you know, at least the moneyed spouse.
Yeah, or actually they're more specific than that. I don't want to pay alimony. And I always say to them, no one has ever come through the door with their checkbook out and their pen in hand saying to me, "Hey, Susan, when do I get to write that first alimony check?" You know?
Yeah. It's funny because one time I actually did a presentation to a Rotary club. And when I got there, I didn't realize that it was an all men's Rotary. That particular one was all men. And it was about 150 guys in the room. I was like, oh God, hey, thanks guys for letting me in your boys club. But then when I got to the part about alimony, I was like, okay, so who here loves the word alimony? I get these like glares.
You want to see a bunch of men just like shrink in their seats. Yeah.
Or jump up and run out of the room.
Exactly. So, I mean, it is a universal that no one wants to pay it, but it is a financial reality for many, many people when they're going through divorce.
And by the way, there's more and more women who are paying alimony now too.
That's very true. And I think one of the things that maybe confuses people is just the very simple terminology. There's, you know, you hear alimony, spousal support, maintenance, spousal maintenance, and it really just depends on what jurisdiction you're in, what state you live in, but they all refer to the same thing. They refer to this legal obligation of one spouse to provide monetary support to the other one, and that can be both during the divorce action as well as after the divorce or legal separation are finalized. And every state has their own laws around alimony, but generally the obligation to provide that financial support stems from the financial obligations that you take on when you get married. And I think a lot of people don't even understand that very basic concept that when you get married, it's a big party, it's a wonderful ceremony and all of that, but legally you are entering into a new legal state or status. And with it comes certain legal obligations, one of which is you have certain basic support obligations towards your spouse.
Yeah, you each have an obligation to support each other, technically.
Right. And that doesn't just end when you end the marital status in many cases. And that's where alimony or spousal support come from. You know, that's where with the genesis of the idea. So the concept is also to create sort of an equitable or fair financial situation for the two spouses.
Yeah, it kind of really grew out of an old concept called coverture, you know, where you each were contributing to the relationship in a different way. And, it, you know, traditionally, it was the man who would go out and make the money and the woman who would stay home and take care of the house and the children. And that's kind of really where it came from. And there has been a big movement in certain states to eradicate, you know, permanent alimony and things like that because more and more you see both spouses working and more states are coming to the conclusion that everybody should be supporting themselves and taking care of themselves as well. But there's still a lot of law around alimony and a lot of obligation potentially in every single state has something.
State that doesn't have some sort of alimony or spousal support law.
Right. In Florida, there's actually 6 different kinds of alimony. They're trying to change that now, but, you know, there's bridge the gap and lump sum, and there's, you know, temporary alimony, durational alimony, permanent alimony, bridge the gap alimony, you know, so there's all these different types. But it really just comes down to, as you said, you know, amount and duration. If there is, the threshold question is, do you even get it or will you have to pay it? I mean, that's the threshold question. And the way that we...
Alimony case, right? Is your particular case an alimony case?
Correct. You know, is there going to be any at all? Number one. And the first clue that I look for is what we call a disparity in incomes, which is... you know, does one spouse earn a whole lot more than the other? Disparity means, you know, that it's far apart, disparate. You know, if one spouse makes $50,000 and the other one makes $55,000, that's probably not going to be considered a disparity in income. If one spouse makes $50,000 and the other one makes $500,000, that's a disparity in income. So that's the first clue that I look for.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I've said to any client who's come to me with that question about, will I have to pay alimony? The first place you look is, you know, where the two of you are with respect to your separate incomes. But it's a pretty complicated question after that, because if you do arrive at the conclusion, well, yes, we have that disparity between the incomes. One is making, like you referenced, Rebecca, $500,000 and one is making $50,000. But then you have those pretty difficult questions of, well, okay, so now there's going to be alimony. How much and for how long?
Yes. I would say the second clue I look for is how long have you been married? You know, is if there's a disparate income or disparity in incomes, have you been married a year or have you been married 25 years?
Yeah. That is really probably the second major factor that judges are looking at. But I think right off the bat, one of the things that makes spousal support so complicated, and this is always a surprise to clients when we're mediating or when I've represented them in a divorce action, is that there is, in general, no formula or guideline to calculate how much the alimony is going to be. So many people know that the states all have child support guidelines that are a formula used to calculate child support. But in the case of alimony, it's the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, some states have guidelines. Some states do.
Well, they do, but I can speak to California where I practice. They do have a formula in place for temporary support, meaning the support that a spouse might pay while the action is pending, while it's moving its way through the court system. But that formula does not apply to final, after the judgment, alimony award.
Yeah, I have seen some states where they take some sort of a a measure of each party's incomes and then how long they've been married. And there's some sort of a mathematical equation that they'll apply. And then they come up with, you know, what the range will be for the guidelines. Now, that's not every state. It's not even most states, but some states do. But most states don't have something like that.
Well, even the states that have that, I believe that when it gives the range of what's allowed or what's called for under those that calculation or guidelines, the judge still has discretion to vary from that based upon certain statutory criteria that they can consider, which, you know, is the situation in all the rest of the states is instead of a formula, all of the rest of the states have statutes that set out a number of different factors.
Right.
Has to consider.
Exactly. And, you know, it's age of the parties, health of the parties, whether one party decided to forego a career in order to raise the family. You know, it's usually like 10 or 12 different factors that they look at, lifestyle of the parties. That's.
Well, and in Connecticut, where I practice as well, they can even take into consideration who's more at fault for the breakdown of the marriage. That's one of the factors. So although
yes,
it's a no-fault state, like we've talked about in, you know, other, you know, what no-fault means, what we've talked about in other episodes, that is one area where in Connecticut, at least a judge could say, yeah, you know, all things being, you know, equal, I feel like one person was more at fault and therefore I can, the judge can do something a little different with the alimony award.
Yeah, like we talked about in one of our episodes, Betcha didn't know that adultery can bite you in the ass, even in a no-fault state. That's what we were talking about, that, you know, a no-fault state doesn't mean fault never matters. It just means that you don't need fault to get your divorce. You don't have to prove fault in order to get a divorce. You know, you can just say it's irretrievably broken or whatever and get your divorce. But it doesn't mean that fault never comes into play. And here is exactly one of those areas where fault can come into play. I know in Florida, the statute actually says that the judge can consider infidelity in you know, giving an alimony award. I've never actually seen a judge say, I'm giving more alimony because this person wasn't faithful, but it definitely may have impacted their judgment when it came to, you know, if I could give them $5,000 a month versus $6,000 a month versus $7,000 a month, I'm going to go for the seven because, you know, the guy cheated or she cheated or whatever. So it can come into play for sure.
Well, and that's a good point, because what I think many people don't understand about the statutes and the criteria that a judge needs to consider is there's no hierarchy of those criteria. The judge has to consider them all, but it's up to the judge how much weight to give to each one. And they don't necessarily even need to set out in their decision, well, I thought this was the most important criteria or that. They do need to say that they considered all the criteria, but it's up to the judge on what weight they're going to give. So you can see, even with, you know, just to use the example of fault for the breakdown of the marriage. Well, the two parties going through the divorce in a courtroom setting talking about who's more at fault, Rebecca, I mean, how much time can be spent giving evidence and testimony about why you think it's more your husband or your wife's fault or your soon-to-be ex-spouse's fault, why the marriage broke down? Hours can be spent trying.
Oh my God, hours are spent already just listening to, you know, every client going on about, you know, why that happened or whatever. And by the way, you know, alimony is based on substantive facts. It's not going to be based on, you know, what I call divorce justice. You know, just because you think the other person should pay more because, you know, that person broke up the marriage, or, you know, you thought you were going to be married forever, and so therefore you should be able to continue to share in the other person's income forever because they're the ones that wanted the divorce. It doesn't work that way. I mean, they look at you know, the factors that are set forth in the statute, and that's that.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot, you know, that's one of the problems around the alimony issue, and one of the reasons why it's such a complicated issue in every divorce is because each one of those 12 or 13 factors that Rebecca referenced earlier needs to, if you can't decide what alimony is going to be or negotiate that between the two of you, you have to put on evidence in front of a judge about all of those different criteria. And that can take forever, but even gathering the information to put in front of the judge, the discovery process. As an example, I mean, Rebecca, you have determining the income of both of the parties. That's a factor a judge would have to take into consideration, how much money they both make. And that sounds simple. Right?
Well, it's really simple if you're a W-2 employee who, you know, you go to work every day and you make X amount, you know, like a teacher or somebody like that. But if you are self-employed or your spouse is self-employed, it is way more complicated because, you know, for example, there are things that are deductible for the income tax, like cell phones, you know, that you can run through your business or travel
business
or meals or entertainment,
right,
or car payments or whatever. All of that stuff is perfectly okay to deduct in for your income taxes. But in a family law setting, those things are likely going to be added back to count your income.
At least for determining support, right? So, but think about all of the evidence that you need to gather. What were those expenses? Are they allowable? And are you the person who makes the determination as to whether they're allowable? Not usually. Usually you need an expert who can give an opinion about what's an allowable deduction for tax purposes and what is not. So,
well, and then you
hiring.
Can get into the battle of the experts because you'll need, a forensic accountant, and then each forensic accountant will have their own things that they think should be added back to income or things that aren't, you know, those things that are maybe on the fence, you know, sort of on the borderline. Well, this trip was for pleasure, but it was also for business or, you know, whatever. So should it be a straight business expense, which doesn't get added back to income or not, you know?
Right, right. And so that goes on, you know, there's a myriad of different details that you have to pull together to try and prove the business expenses. There's also those situations, and it happens with self-employed people. I had one case where a gentleman had a business that traditionally had a large amount of cash that flowed through the business, right? And so he claimed on his income tax returns that he made approximately $60,000 a year for income tax purposes. But when we pulled together all of his expenses, and by the way, he had 2 homes, 5 cars, a boat on the lake, they took some lovely vacations. It turned out to fund the lifestyle he was living, he'd need income in approximately the $250,000 to $300,000 range. So there was a little bit of an issue there for him in his $60,000 of declared income. But, you know, that
well,
was,
and
that
so
took
it's
months.
Kind of proving the negative, right? It's like, right, well, he must make $250,000 because this has been their lifestyle. It's a little bit harder to do it that way, but at least, you know, unless there's been some big savings account that's being depleted or money is being infused from some other source, then obviously this has been the amount that they've lived on. But it is harder to do it that way. You know, one of the things that I want to make sure that we mention to our listeners is that there is a huge difference between alimony and child support. They are two different animals for two different purposes, two totally different areas of the law as far
absolutely.
As the law is concerned.
They are. Yeah, absolutely. You know, child support is actually the right of the children to receive support from both of their parents. It gets paid to one of the parents by the other parent, but it's purposely for the children themselves. Whereas as we get into the alimony and the you know, spousal support, as we said, that ties back to that obligation to support a spouse and trying to create an equitable situation between the two spouses, which brings up another big issue that comes up quite often in determining alimony. And that's where you have one of the parties to the marriage has been out of the workforce for a long period during the marriage.
Breaking Free Mediation is proud to be the very first family law mediation centers in the country to offer a mindfulness track. Breaking Free Mediation, helping you resolve your family law matter peacefully. Learn more at www.breakingfreemediation.com. Also, make sure to download your free meditation at www.breakingfreefromdivorce.com/free-meditation. Coming up, more from Susan and Rebecca on alimony, the real facts about the scariest word in divorce.
Well, she was not happy when I told her that she was going to be on the hook to paying alimony for a period of time, because she was like, well, I never agreed to allow him to stay home. He just did that.
Take a listen to our archive, where you can hear Rebecca and Susan discuss more topics on divorce in depth, including With This Ring, I Move On, with Worthy's public relations guru, Judy Herbst.
And they say diamonds are forever, and maybe diamonds are, but unfortunately, with more than a million people a year, I think there's a divorce every 13 seconds or something, marriages are not forever.
And now we return to today's show.
Becoming less common, you know, Rebecca said earlier, now we have more people where both, or more families where both parents or both parties are in the workforce. But historically, you know, and I'll generalize, but it was, you know, the mom traditionally who stayed home, raised the family, took care of the home, and dad who went out and was the breadwinner. And now you have the situation where the parties are separating and you have one person who hasn't worked for 10, 15 years. And so how do they become self-supporting? It sounds great. Well, you have a law degree. Fine. You haven't worked as a lawyer for 15 years. How do they actually go out, get a job, and be relevant in a market that has probably moved beyond them in the 15 years or however long it's been that they've been out of the workforce, right, Rebecca?
Exactly. And that's where maybe a rehabilitative type of alimony might come into play, you know, which is something that, you know, you would get in order to, but, you know, rehabilitative alimony is usually tied to some sort of a plan where you're actually finishing school, or maybe you have to get a certain number of credit hours in order to be recertified in whatever area you were certified in. Sometimes a vocational evaluation is appropriate, where, you know, a psychologist who actually is certified in testing people for vocation, their vocational ability to earn. And they'll actually come up with a report, which will say, this is how much this person should be able to earn. They actually go out and contact employers and make sure that there's jobs open, you know, in that field.
Region.
And they'll create a report. You know, that's not inexpensive. You're going to spend a few thousand dollars for that at least. But hey, if it's the difference between a minimum wage imputation of income and $75,000 a year, it may be worth it.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, yes, alimony gets paid, but I would say certainly the growing trend in the alimony world, certainly since I started practicing almost 30 years ago, when alimony was a much more common thing and long-term alimony was a much more common thing. Now I think there's a general belief that the recipient of support has an obligation, in fact, to become self-supporting within a reasonable time. They're going to get a runway, like you're talking about with the vocation, you know, getting back up to speed to get back out there in the world. But at some point in time, the court and the judicial system expects that that recipient is going to do something to get back on their feet, start earning and supporting themselves. I know California.
I mean, unless they're older. I mean, you know, if somebody's like in their late 60s or 70s or 80s, they're not going to be expected to, you know, jump back into the workforce at that stage. But
no, I mean, there's reasonable expectations. But if you are a person who could be out working, you know, there's going to be some sort of certain expectation you get back out there. I was saying in California, they actually have something called the Gavron warning. Gavron was a case that established that obligation to become self-supporting on a spouse. And they give that warning, they call it, you know, anytime that alimony is ordered. But,
yeah,
you know, just a big argument can be how long the runway is. I've never heard, or do not often hear anyway, the payor of alimony going, oh, take your time, go back to school. I mean, the perception is you could go out and get a job right now. I hear that all the time in mediations, you know, that the other party who's faced with getting back out into the working world isn't doing it with enough alacrity, is not doing it.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, where are the resumes you're sending out? How many job interviews have you gone on? Things like that. But, you know, one of the other things is I actually had a woman one time. She was a hospital administrator whose husband had stopped working about 5 years prior. And, you know, he had started to try to look for a job for the first year or two or whatever. And then when they kind of settled into this thing for the 3 years leading up to the divorce, where he was just playing golf and, you know, he was allegedly looking for a job, but not really. And he was allegedly depressed, even though he was hanging out with friends all the time and golfing on a daily basis. Well, she was not happy when I told her that she was going to be on the hook to paying alimony for a period of time. Because she was like, well, I never agreed to allow him to stay home. He just did that.
Yeah. Well, those are the exact words I have heard before. Yeah. I didn't say that was okay.
Right. But, you know, when you're in the marriage, you don't realize that by, you know, not divorcing them right away at that point, now from the court's perspective, you're on the hook. You know, you've been supporting him. So the court's not going to just send him out on the street. So you're going to have to give them that runway, as you said.
Well, because that runway, you know, the bottom line is the court wants you paying for their runway, not the state of California or Connecticut or Florida or wherever you happen to live. So you took on the responsibility when you married the person. You stayed married to them for however long they were out of work or out of the workforce. Whatever discussions you may have had about it, judges don't generally take the fact that you wanted them to get a job into consideration. It's what the realistic expectation for that person getting back out there.
Right. And what's the snapshot in time right now? What's been happening, you know, for the year or two leading up to the divorce, you know? So the other thing I wanted to mention is I always tell people about the need versus ability to pay sort of balance test, you know, and the need is like, you know, alimony is not meant to, you know, raise your lifestyle at all, certainly. And it's not for every single detail of every piece of your life. You know, it's usually, you know, what do you need to live on that's somewhat commensurate with the lifestyle, but they're not going to give the person who needs alimony, you know, some unreasonable amount of the other person's paycheck. You know, the other person gets to live too. So that's where the ability to pay piece comes in, you know, and the other person gets to keep the majority of what he or she is going to earn. I mean, you know, the most that the other person might get in alimony might be a third.
Yeah.
So,
I've had awards be more than that, but there were reasons for doing that, maybe a shorter term or something like that.
Yeah, it's not the norm.
No, absolutely not.
So, and a third is even pretty high. That's normally for a very long-term marriage when, you know, there's been, and there's enough to go around. You know, I mean, if you couldn't afford your lifestyle before, the judge isn't going to make the payor go into debt so that he or she can pay your alimony.
No, I actually had a judge once, a woman stated out loud after the judge made the order of alimony and the person was unhappy with the amount, you know, that the judge awarded, saying, well, that's not enough for me to live on. It doesn't meet my expenses. And the judge actually said, well, I'm sorry, ma'am, but the robe did not come with a magic wand. I can't make money appear.
And yeah, we're not Rumpelstiltskin over here, creating, spinning money, you know, spinning whatever.
Out of gold, out of straw, right? Gold out of straw. No, yeah. I mean, that is a very, you know, factual statement that I think every study I've ever read is that the recipient of alimony's lifestyle or standard of living takes a hit because when you take that income and spread it among two households, it's just not the same household or income that you had when you were together.
Right. And a lot of people come in to, a lawyer's offices and they say, well, what about my lifestyle? I'm supposed to be maintaining my lifestyle because they've heard lifestyle is part of this whole equation. But there's also reality, you know, and if the reality is that there's not enough income to maintain the lifestyle, then there's just not, you know. Right. So, and lifestyle, by the way, is one of those other areas that potentially a forensic accountant could get involved with, because they can look at, you know, okay, I'm saying my lifestyle requires $5,000 a month, you know, or the other person says, no, the lifestyle requires $10,000 a month or whatever. And so they actually can start digging into every way that you've ever spent money over the past year or two, your credit card statements, your bank statements, and they actually categorize it out into auto expenses, groceries, meals and entertainment, and, you know, all the different areas, and they come up with a real number for lifestyle.
Right.
You know, one of the things that we definitely need to mention, by the way, since we're almost at the end of our time, we would be totally remiss if we didn't talk about the new tax changes.
Absolutely. Yeah, big changes coming about as a result, and most people have heard about this, but the new Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed in the past year has a provision in it that says, essentially, as of December 31st, 2018, alimony will no longer be deductible. So what does that mean? Well, since for as long as Rebecca and I have been practicing, alimony has been deductible from income by the person who pays it. Meaning if that person makes $100,000 a year and pays $30,000 in alimony, they only pay federal taxes on $70,000 of income per year. And the person who receives the $30,000 of alimony pays taxes, presuming they have no other income, on $30,000 of income. And what that did is it actually allowed, you know, a maneuvering of tax brackets so that each party paid taxes for a lesser tax bracket, and it allowed more money to be available between the two households. But now, starting January 1, 2019, alimony is no longer deductible by the payor, and it's no longer includable in income by the recipient. What that net effect is, I know many recipients are like, oh, yay, I don't have to pay taxes on my alimony. But you have to remember, you're getting your alimony out of post-tax dollars now. And if your ex-spouse has a higher income and they're in a higher tax bracket, they're now paying you alimony out of their higher taxed income. So really the net effect is that more money is going to go to the government in taxes and less of it is available for your two households.
Yeah. Right? So when they take a look at going back to my need versus ability to pay, the ability to pay will now be less because
exactly.
they're taking more in taxes. Just a quick note that, you know, people should also think about when you're doing your agreements, whether or not alimony is going to be modifiable. There's usually a provision in the statute, but if you want to change what the statute provides for, you can. Be careful about living in a supportive relationship, because that can sometimes be a mechanism to modify or even terminate alimony.
You mean like a cohabitation situation where, you know, where you are living in a relationship with someone that's all but married, and they are financially contributing to your household. That's usually the key factor, is that the other party is contributing.
Correct.
And this is for the recipient of the alimony. But some states even have, I know Connecticut does, have a statute specifically stating that if you are a recipient of alimony and you are living with someone who is contributing into your household, and that doesn't even have to be a romantic relationship in that state.
No.
It could be any adult person
any
who's not related to you.
Any supportive relationship.
Yep. And that can be grounds for the other party to move to modify or terminate your alimony award. But there are other, we should just quickly mention that there are reasons why alimony, you know, people will go through the long process of determining and negotiating or getting a judgment as to what their alimony is. And then they're shocked and appalled to find out that that is not set in stone, and that when things change in the future, there can be a modification of their award. And common things that will change are your ex-spouse loses their job and they no longer have that $500,000 a year of income, or they retire. People retire.
Or they get sick and now they're unable to work or something like that. It usually has to be unforeseeable, and it usually has to be a substantial change that's, you know, unforeseeable, involuntary, and permanent.
Right.
You know, like, you can't just quit your job and say, oh, well, I don't have the money to pay you anymore.
Right.
Because, you know, and it has to be unforeseeable. I actually had a modification of alimony case one time during the tech bubble burst, where the husband had agreed to pay the wife $10,000 a month in alimony, and he was a stockbroker. And when the tech bubble burst, he wasn't even making $10,000 a month. And, you know, the court would not allow a modification because that was the fact that the stock market might go up and down was not unforeseeable.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is harsh.
Yeah.
But, well, and another substantial change that comes about fairly often that can lead to a modification is when the recipient of the support, their income goes up, or something happens to their financial situation of a positive nature that's substantial. The person who's paying can say, hey, wait, why should I be paying as much as I was when you were earning zero? You're now earning $50,000 a year. There should be a change. So those are all factors that the court will look into in determining, one, if there's been a substantial change in circumstances sufficient to warrant a modification, and if there was, what now is the appropriate amount of the award. But that is something to be aware of. Unless you make your alimony award non-modifiable, it may be modifiable in the future. So that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I you know, we could probably talk about this for hours on end.
But yeah, we could.
We'll probably have to do a part two to this. But this was
actually, if you have more questions, let us know what they are, and maybe we'll be able to do a second episode outlining, answering some of the questions, because this really is one of those areas where I think I receive more questions than any other area of the law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we look forward to hearing your questions. Just remember, alimony can be the most scariest word in divorce, but it also doesn't necessarily have to be. Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce Podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. Breaking Free Mediation is proud to be the very first family law mediation centers in the country to offer a mindfulness track. Breaking Free Mediation, helping you resolve your family law matter peacefully. Learn more at www.breakingfreemediation.com.
Also, make sure to download your free calming meditation from renowned meditation and energy expert, Scott Picard, at www.breakingfreefromdivorce.com/free meditation.
Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating and let us know what you liked in a review on iTunes.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.